Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. Today we have with us Robert Delfino, who is professor of philosophy at St. John's University in New York City. He's the editor of a few volumes, one on Plato's Cratylus, another one entitled Understanding Moral Weakness, and another one entitled What Are We to Understand Gratia to Mean? He's also edited the series Studies in the History of Western Philosophy, so he's got wide coverage in Western philosophy. He has a new book co-authored with Matt Frad entitled Does God Exist? A Socratic Dialogue on the Five Ways of Thomas Aquinas. Welcome, Professor Delfino.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Okay, now the book, Thomas Aquinas is in the title, but this is not an ordinary scholarly study of Thomas Aquinas. Why don't you just let us in on what the format is and how you came up with this?
Well, I co-wrote the book with Matt Frad, and I have to give him credit. He had the idea for writing a Socratic dialogue. He wanted something that would be accessible to, you know, a younger generation. And actually, I was very happy with this because I always felt that Mortimer Adler was right, that philosophy is important for everybody. It's everybody's business. And so when Matt contacted me years ago to give him some comments on an early draft of this, I liked the fact that he had it as a dialogue because I wanted people to, you know, the average person to really get into philosophy. Now philosophy, unfortunately, is kind of locked in the ivory tower, and that's no good. So that was one of the rationales for the book. And of course, the other rationale for the book is that, you know, we're living in a very secular age now, and it saddens me that about one third of all adults under the age of 30 identify as nuns. Not Roman Catholic nuns, but people who say they have no religion, no particular religion, no religious preference. And so we have this really rich intellectual tradition in Roman Catholicism. And I figured that, you know, I would like to help Matt work on this so that some of those arguments, those rational arguments why God exists, would get out there to the larger public.
Mm-hmm. And so you have the dialogue format. It's really it lays out a conversation. Is Socrates one of the characters?
No, it's AJ and Lucia, boy and a girl in a coffee shop, and they're both around college age or slightly older.
This is chapter one is entitled "An Atheist and a Christian Walk into a Coffee Shop," which is, you know, like the first line of a joke, right? And so it establishes straight off, and we actually jump right into the conversation. You do have some prefatory material here. Matt talks about being a teenager and losing his faith and then regaining his faith on a trip to Rome. But you really are clearly trying to tap into the adolescent who is, you know, 16, 17 years old, who's growing up and the world is starting to look like a big place. And the religion of his parents or the traditional church-going patterns just don't reach him, don't touch him. But he is looking for some forms of meaning and value in the world.
Look at the Jordan Peterson phenomenon, right? I mean, so many young people, especially young men, are looking for some kind of deeper meaning that the secular world really can't provide them. And while I think Jordan does a good service in many ways, I think obviously what young people need to find is God.
I think he's getting young people to address the question. He doesn't really answer the question, does he? He plays it very coy.
He kind of dances around it, yeah.
Right. And I think it's something, I actually think that it would be wise for Jordan Peterson's next step to go ahead and stop dancing and take a stand. Somewhere, whatever that stand may be, I think that's what people, what young people are going to want. But the meaning question. This is hitting a lot of young people because liberalism, secular liberalism, provides substitutions for transcendence that often go wrong. For example, the more zealous forms of social justice or the fanatical forms of environmentalism. It can go in a lot of different directions, but many of these just don't work out very well.
I know it's an attempt to have the social gospel, but without the gospel.
That's right. And I think that ultimately that there is a deep desire for transcendence that fuels a lot of these concerns, and a non-transcendent answer is always going to be at least to some degree unsatisfying. So this format, I think, is very effective. I can see a teacher in a freshman class in college on issues of metaphysics and God really reenacting some of these conversations as an opening into the philosophical questions. And so I actually was reading it and thought, I'll tell our listeners that Robert and I decided we would just go ahead and reenact the conversations if we can do that.
Sure, that sounds good.
Okay, well, I'll play the atheist, and you will play the Christian. So they're in a coffee shop, and so you can begin. This is Lucy and AJ. So I'm AJ, you're Lucy. Let's begin with the, here's the opening of the book. Let's go.
All right, this is page 5. I'm an atheist, debate me? Wow, that sure is a cute confrontational shirt you got there.
Yeah, got it online. Glad you like it.
I'm Lucy.
AJ. And now I feel awkward because you're reading
the Bible? Yep.
Mind if I join you?
I'm a bit hesitant, but okay.
Thanks. Look what I'm here to read.
Wow, Dawkins. The God delusion. How original of you.
Yeah, I could say the same about you. The Bible?
Touché. Is this the part where you get all confrontational?
Maybe. Dawkins says...
I've read it.
Really?
Really.
Do you remember what he said about the God of the Old Testament?
Yeah, I do. But go ahead. Refresh my memory.
Quote, "The God of the Old Testament is arguably the most unpleasant character in all fiction. Jealous and proud of it. A petty, unjust, unforgiving control freak. A vindictive, bloodthirsty ethnic cleanser. A misogynistic, homophobic, racist, infanticidal, genocidal, filicidal, pestilential, megalomaniacal, sadomasochistic, capriciously malevolent bully."
You know, let me just interject and say at this point, this is the classic moment where you have to say it to Dawkins. No, really, don't hold back. Tell me how you really feel.
Yeah, well, this I think is the secret of the extraordinary success of that book and why he rose to be one of the four horsemen of the new atheists, because it was so over the top denunciation. I mean, he went all the way in reducing Christianity, religion in general, to really the schoolyard, right? And the taunting. This was a rhetoric that you could see so many of the irreverent atheists just smiling with glee when they read descriptions like that.
Well, I mean, some of them have had some abuse and some of them have had a lot of pain in their lives, but that doesn't mean the intellectual argument's really good. Certainly this might satisfy some of that angst that they have.
Do you think that behind this virulent form of atheism that we do have resentment against parents, perhaps fathers, most of all?
You know, that's an interesting question. There was a book out about 5 years ago. I think it's called The Making of an Atheist. My friend told me about it. And he said that one of the theses of the book was that with the breakdown of the family and with absent or not so good father figures, there seems to be a correlation between atheism and that. I don't know. Have you found anything about that? Or do you have a thesis about that?
You know, I remember reading many years ago, I might have been a student in a psychology class, finding that one common thread in a lot of more militant atheists is either anger or disappointment in the father. That a relationship, a bad relationship to a father figure in some form, becomes a root cause of atheism. That if we found young men, and I mean mostly in men, not women. I think this was focused on men, but the new atheists, I mean the angry atheists, right? I can't think of at least in recent times, very many women who are angry atheists, resentful atheists of this kind. Am I wrong?
No, I think you're right. I think the statistics show that the greatest number of atheists are actually white men. I think I have a little bit of a thesis on that. I've read a little bit about this. You know, men tend to be, or we can get very conceptual, right? Whereas I think women are more naturally connected and loving of people. And I think that grounds them a little better in God. But, you know, maybe I'm crazy. What do I know? I'm a member of the the old white philosophy guard, right?
Yeah. But I mean, there are, you know, some prominent female atheists. You know, Heather McDonald is an atheist. Camille Paglia is an atheist. But they're not angry about it. They're not. You don't feel like they're getting back at someone or something for not having any transcendent belief.
Well, really quick, and then we'll get back to the text. But in Dawkins' defense, two things. One, I believe he did say openly that when he was younger, one of the clerics did abuse him a little bit. And I have, of course, sympathy for that. But secondly, I think the big thing, and we talk about this later in the book a bit, is I think, you know, nature is red in tooth and claw, as people in Darwin's time would say. And it's hard sometimes to reconcile a good God with all of the violence and evil in the world. So we address that in one of the other chapters. Should we get back to the text?
Okay. So I quoted Dawkins's description of God. Your turn.
Right. And Lucy says, "It's well written for sure, his book as a whole. However, I found it disappointing. I hope you're not wearing that shirt because of Dawkins. Why are you an atheist anyway?"
Well, partly because, let's see here. Quote, "The God of the Old Testament is arguably the most unpleasant."
I get it.
You asked.
How does that follow, though?
How does what follow?
"This religion's account of God is horrid. Therefore, God does not exist."
It's not just that it's horrid. It's that it's contradictory. In the Old Testament, he's a malevolent bully. In the New Testament, he's a peace-loving hippie.
Well, as formidable as your biblical interpretation skills are, so what? Let's say you're right. Maybe the Bible is false.
Well, I'm glad we agree. My latte is ready. One sec. Sorry about that. Continue.
Seriously? The great atheist debater said yes to sprinkles?
Hey, sprinkles are awesome, okay? So where were you? What were you saying?
I was saying maybe the Bible is false. Obviously, I don't think that, but let's suppose I'm wrong. How would that prove that God doesn't exist?
Well, it's not just the Bible. Every formulation of God's existence from every religion I've studied, and I've studied a lot, amounts to nothing more than anthropomorphic twaddle.
Okay, let's say you're right. I still don't think that's a good reason to think that God does not exist. That would be like me saying, I've studied the history of alien abductions. I've interviewed every living claimant and found all their stories to be bogus. Therefore, aliens do not exist. Do you see how that's a logical fallacy? The conclusion doesn't follow from the premises.
I think it's important to remember, Lucy, that you're the one who has the burden of proof here. You're the one who claims God exists.
I agree I have a burden of proof, but so do you, unless you're not an atheist after all.
This is a common misconception. An atheist isn't one who says God does not exist. An atheist just lacks belief in the God you claim does exist. And all gods, for that matter.
Don't take this the wrong way, but I'm not actually interested in what you believe.
Ouch!
What I mean is, if you're going to redefine atheism to mean lack of belief, then what you're doing is trivializing what has traditionally been meant by atheism. This definition of yours would make atheism not a claim to knowledge, but merely a state of mind. And I'm not interested in your state of mind. I'm interested in what's true.
It's not a redefinition. That's what I've always meant by it.
See, I know enough to know that's not true. I'm in the process of getting my master's degree in philosophy, and one of the standard encyclopedias we use is the Routledge Encyclopedia of Philosophy.
You literally just pulled an encyclopedia out from your bag?
Like I said, I study philosophy. Here's what it says, quote, "Atheism is the position that affirms the non-existence of God. It proposes positive disbelief rather than mere suspension of belief," end quote. What you're talking about is agnosticism from the Greek word agnostos, meaning without knowledge.
Look, I think that if I made the sincere effort to discover the truth about something and found all the evidence in favor of that thing lacking, then I'm justified in saying that that thing doesn't exist. Besides, you're an atheist with regards to every other god humanity has postulated. I just go one step further. I'm consistent.
Okay, 2 points. Let me address the you're an atheist about every other god one first. You're right. I don't believe in Zeus, Thor, Horus, or any other pagan god. But that doesn't make me an atheist. An atheist is someone who doesn't believe in God. I do believe in God, therefore I'm not an atheist. Let me give you an analogy. Do you think that monarchy is a good form of government?
You know, just to interrupt for a moment, that reminds me of Wallace Stevens. One of his adagia is, the death of one god is the death of all.
Ah.
Anyway, back. Okay, so you asked about monarchy, good form of government. AJ, no.
What about kakistocracy, where the government is led by the least qualified to govern? Do you think that is a good form of government?
I thought that was what we were in now, no? No, I don't think that's a good form of government. What's your point?
My point is, I'm no more an atheist because I reject some versions of God than you are an anarchist because you reject some forms of government. Now, on to your first point about having made a good effort to see if a thing is true. Now we're going around in circles. Remember what I said about the aliens? Suppose I make a sincere effort to discover the truth about extraterrestrial life and find all the evidence in favor of it lacking. That doesn't warrant the conclusion that aliens don't exist. They may still exist even though we have no good evidence to think they do.
So you're saying God's an alien?
Now I have to interject here. If you've ever seen that great debate with Kathy Newman and Jordan Peterson, she kept saying, so this is a lobster or this is that.
So what you're saying is, well, what you're saying is, and he looks at her and says, no, that's...
Exactly. It was great. But this line was written a few years earlier than that.
But it's the exact same thing. So what you're saying is God's an alien.
Right. And Lucy says, no, I'm saying God may exist even if you think there are no good reasons to believe.
Well, what reasons do you have to think God exists?
Wait a minute. Before we get to that, we need to finish defining our terms. Have you read Trent Horn's book, Answering Atheism? If not, you need to read it. He says there are 3 ways a person can respond to the question, does God exist? Yes, no, or maybe. It therefore makes sense that we have 3 terms. If you say yes, you're a theist. If you say no, you're an atheist. And if you say maybe, you're an agnostic. And if you do say no, as you've done, then you're making a claim to knowledge that you need to give reasons for. Even one will do. So, what is your reason? And that ends chapter one.
That ends chapter one. So this is the opening. This is the debate that begins, and we're going to evolve through different chapters. One of them is the problem of evil. That is chapter 2. Chapter 3 goes into the question of the scientific basis for proof. And what do you say, Robert, that we jump to chapter 3 and go into the, as you put it, is science the only way to know truth?
Sure. Let me just make a few quick comments first. So the chapter on evil and then the next chapter, as you mentioned, on is science the only way to knowledge or truth? Those 2 chapters mirror the 2 objections that St. Thomas Aquinas treats in the Summa Theologiae. In the Summa Theologiae, he says, he always asks these questions, you know, does God exist? And he always has the objections. And those are the 2 big objections. So we had 2 chapters for those. Okay, let's jump to chapter 3.
Let's inform our listeners that this is a conversational way of getting to the core questions and answers that Aquinas lays out.
Right. In fact, the best compliment I've received in speaking with people was that what they liked about the dialogue format was that often when they heard an argument, they initially had an objection, but then it was answered in the next paragraph. So that worked out.
Good. Well, that's the dialogue mode, right?
Right. So chapter 3, Lucy starts off because AJ walks in the room and Lucy says, see, now that's a much more respectable shirt.
What can I say? Our conversation yesterday really impacted me. I think you might be right about this whole Christianity thing.
Seriously?
No.
You're hysterical.
I do what I can. So yesterday, you tried to show why my reasons for being an atheist aren't good. But do you have any positive reasons for thinking God exists? You do believe God's existence can be proven, right?
It depends on what you mean by prove, AJ. I don't think God's existence can be proven scientifically, for example, in physics or chemistry. But I do think that we can make a philosophical argument from things we observe about the world to a cause that strongly resembles the God of Christianity.
I feel like you're trying to get out of proving God by science.
No, that's not what I'm trying to do.
Sounds like it to me.
No, I'm saying that God's existence cannot, in principle, be proved by modern science. Let me give you two reasons why, okay?
I'm listening.
Okay, the first reason, and I don't think you're going to like it, is that the scientific method of experimentation can't prove any theory definitively.
You're right. I don't like it. Plus, I think you're wrong. I mean, we've gained so much knowledge from science that I can't believe you just said that. Think of all the technology and life-saving medical procedures we have from science.
AJ, I'm not anti-science. But when it comes to proof with a capital P, the scientific method does have limitations. And I'm not the first one to say this. The famous philosopher of science, Karl Popper, argued that a theory or statement, quote, can never be finally established by establishing some of its consequences, end quote.
You're going to have to do better than that. Appeal to authority, really?
Okay, let me give you an historical example that makes my point. Isaac Newton's theory of physics made predictions that were testable by the scientific method. For about 250 years, his theory passed all the experimental tests. I'm sure some people thought his theory had been proven true. But then Einstein came along. As objects approach the speed of light, Newton's theory no longer makes accurate predictions about their behavior, whereas Einstein's theory of relativity does. So passing almost three centuries of tests was not enough to prove Newton's theory true. Scientific theories are always tentative because there's always a possibility that future evidence will show them to be flawed in some way.
Yeah, but even if Newton's theory wasn't totally true, there's still a lot of truth in it. Otherwise, it wouldn't have made so many true predictions.
I agree with you. It's inconceivable that Newton's theory could be totally false and yet make so many true predictions. But while it's fair to say that Newton's theory approximated the truth, given certain parameters, that still falls short of proof in the strict sense.
You said you had two reasons why God's existence can't be proven by science. What's the other one?
Simply that the existence of God isn't a scientific question. It's a philosophical one. So the scientific method isn't even appropriate in this case.
Why not? Dawkins says, the existence of God is a scientific hypothesis like any other.
I know, but he's wrong.
Oh, well, in that case.
Let me explain why. If the Christian understanding of God is correct, then God exists outside of space and time. But if that's true, then scientists can never study God directly. Do you think you can study something that exists outside of space and time in a laboratory?
Probably not.
Probably not?
Well, maybe they could come up with some clever experiments to detect God indirectly.
I have doubts about that. But even if that were possible, lack of detection would not disprove God's existence. That was the point I made yesterday about aliens. Plus, there's another problem.
What's that?
Most scientists agree that science limits itself to the study of the natural world. In other words, science has nothing to say about things outside of the natural world. I'm not sure why you look so surprised. This is something recognized by both theists and atheists alike. Have you heard of the evolutionary biologist Stephen Jay Gould?
I have. He's an atheist.
Right. I have one of my favorite quotations from him on my phone. Here's what he says about all of this. Quote, to say it for my colleagues and for the upteenth millionth time, science simply cannot, by its legitimate methods, adjudicate the issue of God's possible superintendence of nature. We neither affirm nor deny it. We simply can't comment on it as scientists. If some of our crowd have made untoward comments claiming that Darwinism disproves God, then I will fine Mrs. McInerney and have their knuckles wrapped for it for as long as she can equally treat those members of our crowd who have argued that Darwinism must be God's method of action. Science can work only with naturalistic explanations. It can neither affirm nor deny other types of actors like God in other spheres, end quote.
It seems a little much that you're willing to say science is a reliable guide when it comes to everything else we know, but not when it comes to God. Do you see how suspicious that sounds?
It might if that's what I were saying, but I'm not. There are many things we know to be true that can't be known through science.
Like what?
Okay, do you know that you exist and that you're having this conversation with me?
Ah, the joys of philosophical discourse. Yes, of course.
Well, that's something you know to be true, but not through the scientific method. In fact, science would not be possible if we didn't have other, non-scientific forms of knowledge, such as memory, observational knowledge, and linguistic knowledge. Not to mention that science can't prove or even investigate the laws of logic or mathematical truths. It merely presupposes them. And the same is true about morality. Science can't show that we have a duty to help a starving child, or that the Nazi concentration camps were evil. Good and evil are not material entities that can be measured in a laboratory. But here's the death knell. You're claiming that we shouldn't accept anything as true unless it can be proven true by science, right?
I think that's what I would have said until this conversation.
Ha! It's good to know you're humble. But listen, even if we weaken the claim to, quote, you shouldn't accept anything as true unless it can be supported by scientific evidence, end quote, there would still be a problem.
Because you can't support that claim by scientific evidence?
Precisely. It's self-defeating. It's careful reasoning we need to use, not science alone. And keep in mind, just yesterday you were using a philosophical argument to show how evil disproves, or at least makes less likely, the existence of an all-powerful, all-knowing, and all-loving God. If you're open to philosophical arguments disproving the existence of God, shouldn't you be open to philosophical arguments that might prove his existence?
Okay, fair enough. But you haven't given me any. So lay them on me, these reasons of yours. I'm an open-minded guy. What I'm after is the truth. What reasons can you give me for God's existence?
Now, let me make a little commentary. I hope it's probably a little bit clear at this point, but it gets even clearer later on as AJ starts to think more and develop. But we didn't want some cheesy caricature of a college male atheist. No, AJ is actually a good guy overall, and he's sincerely troubled by these issues. And he's mostly open-minded. He's got a few axes to grind here and there, and he likes to be a little snarky. But he's actually a good guy, and as the book develops, he raises so many objections. In fact, we made it our mission to make him really have some good, better and better objections as time goes on. So I want the audience to know that this book is not a hit job. It's actually really meant to address the serious concerns of a lot of people, especially young people nowadays.
So that ends chapter three. So we'll stop reading there. Do you want to give any final remarks on your concluding sections in the book?
Yeah. So let me just talk a little bit about, hopefully this has whet the audience's appetite a little to maybe investigate and maybe buy the book. And the later chapters go over the five arguments Aquinas gives for God. Now, I'm not going to give them all to you, but I'll give you a very brief, one paragraph overview. So the first way to God is to notice that things in the world change, right? And in order to explain how that change is possible, we have to reach a cause that is unchanging. The second way is about causation itself. And we realize that anytime you have a chain of causes, there has to be an uncaused first cause for that to be possible as well. And we go over various examples and objections in the chapter on that in the book. The third way is my favorite. It's about the why does anything exist at all? And Aquinas argues that we know, if you look around the world, when a new baby is born or a loved one passes away, that, they've lost their existence. And so the question comes, they're contingent beings. And the question becomes, can everything in the universe be a contingent being? And Aquinas will argue, no, there has to be a necessary being, and that's God. And then the fourth way, which has a lot of fans, although I find it a little abstract and difficult, but the fourth way is based on our awareness that there's a hierarchy of goodness in the world, right? Some stones are beautiful, right? Diamonds, rubies, things like that. But it's much better to be alive. Like a plant is a better being because it's alive. But humans are even better because we're alive and we're intelligent. And so this hierarchy of being needs a maximum, Aquinas will argue. And the maximum would be the perfect being, which would be God. And then finally, the fifth way is one of the more controversial ones. It's the idea that we notice in the universe that there's things act for an end. There's order. There seems to be purpose. And as a result, there needs to be an intelligence behind it all. And of course, we raise all sorts of objections with evolution and other things and multiple worlds and all that. So that gives you a little taste of what comes later on in the book.
Very good, Professor Delfino. The book, Does God Exist? It is recently out, and I hope you enjoyed that.
Yeah, no, that was great. Thanks for having me, Mo.
Thank you.